For Robin Young, it's Here and Now. The body of Pope John Paul II, flanked by Swiss guards and carried by a dozen pallbearers on a crimson platform, has been moved from an inner sanctum of the Vatican to St. Peter's Basilica. There, pilgrims from around the world will be able to pay their final respects. Meantime, the College of Cardinals has convened for its first two secret meetings at the Vatican. The group's first order of business was to schedule the Pope's funeral, which will be held Friday morning. Sophie Airy writes for the Christian Science Monitor and joins us on the line from Rome. Sophie, welcome, and thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Bob.
Start by telling us a little bit about the procession to St. Peter's Basilica. It finished a short time ago. What did it look like? How were the crowds?
Well, crowds have been massing in St. Peter's Square all day, knowing that this was happening this afternoon, and knowing that once the ceremony, which is now underway, is complete, they will be able to start filing through the church to see the Pope's body themselves for one last time and pay him their respects. So there's been an enormous and very emotional crowd. Many of them have actually never been as near to the Pope in his life as they may now be for a few moments in his death. So this is really a very powerful moment for people who have begun to swarm into Rome and gather for this time for the chance to see the Pope's body and then also to be here on Friday when we now know the funeral is set to take place.
What
we actually have happening right now is now that the body has been arrived and been placed in St. Peter's Basilica, there is a mass going on and we are seeing all of the cardinals and the bishops who are present in Rome, as well as, of course, the Swiss guards who you've seen in their multicolored uniforms wearing black cloaks in a symbol of mourning. They are holding a ceremony now, which is the confirmation of the arrival of the Pope's body before the public are allowed to start visiting.
I was wondering if you'd tell me just one more thing about the procession. With all those people standing, watching the Pope's body being moved, was it quiet?
It was a mixture. There have been moments where things have been absolutely silent in the last few days, just at the time when, of course, we knew that the Pope was in his dying hours. People gathered and were very silent. Now what you have is a mixture of sadness, but also celebration of this man who so many people have so much deep respect for. So, yes, there is a moment of awe, and there has been an atmosphere of awe here as the body was transferred, and certainly no cheering or shouting, but quiet murmurings amongst people as they are with each other, feeling the immense weight of this historic moment that they are able to live through right now.
How many people are expected to view the body? We hear that they'll be viewing 21 hours a day until the funeral on Friday.
Yeah, well, the estimates are that there could be up to 2 million people coming to Rome in the next few days, both to see the body and to witness the funeral. Obviously, they're not invited to the funeral, but they will be massing in the square where there'll be giant screens in place so that people can follow the funeral from as close as possible. So we could see up to 2 million people filing through St. Peter's Basilica in the next few days just to catch a glimpse of this Pope.
Is Rome equipped to handle the millions of people? And what measures are being taken to ensure security?
Well, it's a question that we have yet to answer, whether Rome can cope. What's difficult about this situation for the Rome authorities is that although they've known that this funeral would take place for many years, when it's finally confirmed, they only have a very short time in which to prepare themselves for it. So in the next few days, Rome will be frantically getting itself as ready as possible to cope with the large numbers of people. So there have been large security forces put in place, and certain roads at the time of the funeral will obviously be blocked to traffic so that the pedestrians can take over the streets around St. Peter's. There have also been special health services and emergency services put in place, ready to stand by should anybody in the crowds be unwell or have any health problems of any sort. On top of that, Rome is struggling just simply to provide enough beds for all of the people who are on their way here now. Apparently, reports tell us that all the hotel rooms in the whole city are already full, and that the authorities are preparing sleeping accommodation in football stadiums and sports centres and any public buildings that have suitable facilities for all the visitors who may arrive with nothing more than a sleeping bag.
We know that after the funeral on Friday, the Pope will be buried in the grotto of St. Peter's Basilica, but there's talk, or perhaps we should call it hope, in Krakow today that the Pope's heart might be brought back to Poland to be buried there. What have you heard? What have you heard about that?
Well, there has been talk from early times, even before the Pope had died, when actually it was very much taboo to discuss anything about what may happen after he died. This is part of the reason why it's such a last-minute rush for Rome now to cope with this funeral, because until the Pope actually died, it was just not politically correct to talk about the arrangements, and that included the question of whether he might himself have made a personal request to be buried in Poland. We know that from today, we've been told by the Vatican spokesman, Joaquin Navarro-Valls, that the Pope, in his will, didn't make any special request or mention of his funeral. The Poles have very much been thinking and speculating that he could have requested that he be finally laid to rest in Poland. And probably that's where these new reports are coming from now, that we hear that maybe his heart in particular might be making that final journey. It's not confirmed, and to an extent it's possible that this is more wishful thinking on the part of the Polish community, who are so close and attached to this Pope and would be so honoured to have some part of him that return home.
Sophie Erie, who writes for the Christian Science Monitor, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks.
In Washington, Congress returns from its two-week Easter break today, and lawmakers are wondering what effect a new leader of the Catholic Church will have in U.S. politics. At the same time, many in Congress are wondering about the future of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. DeLay harshly criticized judges who rejected appeals to save the life of Terry Schiavo, and he faces corruption and ethics allegations. A new poll shows support for DeLay slipping, and this attack ad from the liberal group Campaign for America's Future isn't helping.
Tom DeLay can't wash his hands of corruption by involving Congress in one family's personal tragedy. But Congress can certainly wash his hands of Tom DeLay.
On the line to tell us how this will all play out in Congress this coming week is Howard Fineman, chief political correspondent for Newsweek. Howard, how are you? And thanks for joining us.
I'm fine, and you're welcome.
Howard, to Tom DeLay in a minute, but first, Congress has two significant deaths to grapple with, the Pope and Terry Schiavo. Leaders of the Catholic Church played a role in the presidential election, and criticizing John Kerry, for instance, for his support of abortion rights. How do you think a new pope might affect political discourse in this country?
Well, the new pope certainly will affect political discourse in this country, as John Paul II did in his long papacy. There are about 65 million Catholics in the United States. They are by far the largest swing constituency, if you can call that many people a swing constituency, because where the Catholics vote, the winners are. and Catholics are divided on many political issues. Thus, who the tone and the teachings of the new pope will, I think, be very influential in American politics. If the new pope takes as tough a line on traditionalism and culture as Pope John Paul II did, that will have an effect. If the new pope is as willing as John Paul was to get involved in the guts of American politics in terms of bishops and others expressing their views and making statements in the church about politics, then that'll be important too. So it couldn't be more important to American politics, this selection of the new pope.
Catholics were overtly courted by Republicans in the last presidential election to vote for George Bush, and essentially against fellow Catholic John Kerry. Some in the Catholic hierarchy in America have gotten quite politically active during John Paul II's tenure, pledging, among other things, to withhold the sacrament of communion from politicians who support abortion rights. Do you expect this activism to continue under the next pope or abate?
I think it will continue. It's just a question of how central the focus will be, because as others have pointed out, there are so many challenges facing the church worldwide in terms of the Third World, in terms of Latin America, in terms of the lack of priests, and in terms of confronting radical Islam and the secularization of Europe. I mean, there are a lot of things to be dealt with. It's a question of focus and energy. I do think that the activism in American politics will continue, and I dare say a lot of the bishops will continue it, whatever happens in Rome, but it's a question of focus and tone.
The death of Terry Schiavo now. Polls show most of the American public disapproved of congressional intervention in the case. Is this case a turning point for social conservatives, a wake-up call, or what?
It's a huge rallying cry. Yes, the polls show that most Americans didn't want Congress intervening. And yes, Tom DeLay's poll numbers are declining. But for conservative faith-based types, Terry Schiavo and the death of Terry Schiavo is a rallying cry, and if anything, is going to make them redouble their efforts to use Senate procedure to try to jam their judges through into the federal judiciary, to push for laws in states such as defining marriage as solely between a man and a woman. In other words, the whole conservative cultural agenda is going to be pushed even harder by Republicans, and in the name of Terry Schiavo now.
Howard Fineman is chief political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. When we return, more on the Schiavo case and more on the future of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay and Social Security reform. Stay with us. There is more ahead here and now. Here and now, continuing our conversation with Howard Fineman, chief political correspondent for Newsweek, about religion and politics, the week ahead in Congress, and Tom DeLay. Over the weekend, a poll in the Houston Chronicle conducted by Zogby showed signs of trouble for the controversial House Majority Leader, Tom DeLay. 40% of the voters in his own district said they like him less than they did last year, and 45% said they'd vote for someone else if there was an election soon. Howard, you most recently wrote about Tom DeLay and said that a new drama of survival has begun in Washington. How so?
Well, I think a lot of Tom DeLay's own Republican colleagues are beginning to get a little worried, if not a little about defending him, and a little tired of defending him. As one of his fellow leaders in the House said to me on a not-for-attribution basis, he said, look, the members, meaning the Republican members of the House, they want us to spend all of our time protecting them. They don't want to spend all of their time protecting us, meaning the leadership. And that was a very pointed comment about the sort of body language of what's going on in the House with regard to DeLay. Tom DeLay has successfully, I think, muffled investigations by state officials in Texas, and he successfully muffled the efforts of the Ethics Committee in the House to investigate his dealings by changing the rules on that committee. But there's now a federal grand jury that's looking into things, and federal grand juries are a little harder to deal with politically. And I think the results of that investigation are unknown. Nobody's, as I said in that web piece, nobody's has yet accused Tom DeLay, nor is there any evidence that we know of any wrongdoing by him, any crimes committed by him. Nobody's accusing him of that. But there are an awful lot of people around town who used to work for him who were perhaps cutting things close in terms of the law in fundraising and political deal-making. And what often happens here in Washington is that machines that people build get big, and then they collapse of their own weight. And I'm just speculating as to whether that time has come for DeLay.
You write that DeLay is fighting for his political life in that web piece. Do you really think he's in real trouble?
Well, I wouldn't have written that if I didn't think so, because I think it could be a long, slow process. But I think his basic mission now is primarily to defend himself. And whenever a politician in town gets in the position of primarily playing defense, it's not a good sign for his long-term health. And if any of his aides are indicted, which is a possibility, then I think he's really got serious problems.
You've also said that relations between President Bush and Tom DeLay have never been particularly warm. How close to is the White House getting to the point where they abandon DeLay? Close or not close at all?
No, I don't think they're ready to abandon him, but they're not going to spend a lot of time and effort defending him, which can be just as damaging from his point of view. The thing about the Bush White House is that they like conservatives, but they like their own conservatives. And Tom DeLay has always been an independent force in Texas. He was an independent conservative political force there before George Bush ran for governor in 1994. He sort of was there already on that turf, and that's the kind of thing that makes George Bush nervous. He wants his own people, especially Texans, and DeLay has never been that.
What impact has the Terri Schiavo Right to Die case had on DeLay? Before she died, he pushed hard for congressional intervention, getting the law passed, encouraging the courts to look at the case again.
Well, he's made himself even more of a hero, I think, among cultural conservatives. But in the practical sense, he was solidifying his base further by making himself a leader of the Save Schiavo forces. But that doesn't necessarily help him elsewhere in the Congress, even with some of his own Republican colleagues. I mean, all of this is still somewhat under the surface right now. But I think we're just beginning to see, especially depending on what happens with that federal grand jury, we're just beginning to see what could be a very long end game for DeLay.
How does this play out in terms of judicial nominees? Will social conservatives become more engaged in the battle over judgeships because of the Terri Schiavo case? Tom DeLay made comments that some thought were rather threatening about the judiciary system in the wake of all of it, saying that some have thumbed their noses at the Congress and the president.
Well, I think what DeLay is trying to do as a matter of survival is to conflate his own legal problems of his network with the attack on the judiciary generally by conservatives. I mean, religious conservatives see a godless judiciary that looks to law above all and has no room for faith, that has no humanity, that has no charity, and they cite the Terri Schiavo case as example A in that. But DeLay is attacking the credibility of the entire judiciary, threatening to impeach judges who were involved in the Schiavo case, and many of his supporters support the idea of making federal judgeships term and not for lifetime. I thought it was very interesting that Dick Cheney, the other day in an interview with the New York Post, said that he supported lifetime appointments for federal judges. That shows you sort of the limits of and shows you the fault line in the Republican Party that the defense of delay, if it gets extreme, could expose.
Quick question on another topic with less than a minute to go, Social Security reform. Some prominent Republicans have expressed doubts about the likelihood that private accounts will pass this year. But Republican Senator Rick Santorum said in a conference call late this morning that interest in Social Security reform is up. Thumbs up or thumbs down on Social Security reform private accounts in this session?
It's not going to happen this year. I'm fairly certain it's not. Santorum's being the team player with the White House. He's winning points with George Bush by being staunch on that. Most strategists you talk to, most conservative Republican strategists, people who want it very much, private accounts, say that it won't happen this year. It may not happen next year. It may take till 2007. They're not going to give up, but this is just the first inning in a ball game for them.
Howard Fineman, chief political correspondent for Newsweek, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, who are some of the men likely to fill Pope John Paul II's shoes? Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Here and Now. The group Al-Qaeda in Iraq has claimed responsibility for Saturday's coordinated attack on the Abu Ghraib prison near Baghdad. The group says 10 attackers were killed during the operation. The U.S. military, however, reports one insurgent killed. Meanwhile, on the political front, Iraqi lawmakers say they've broken a two-month logjam with the appointment yesterday of a new Speaker of the Parliament, an American-educated Sunni politician named Hajim al-Hassani. Joining us from Baghdad with more is Edward Wong, correspondent for The New York Times. Welcome, Ed.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you, and I'm so glad you're with us today. Let me have you start with the weekend attack on the Abu Ghraib prison. This wasn't one car bomber and a few gunmen, was it?
No, this was a very well-organized attack. The officers at Abu Ghraib, whom I spoke with, said that this was the largest attack that insurgents have attempted on the prison since the Americans began using the prison a couple years back. And there were up to 60 insurgents who were involved in the attack. And it was coordinated from two sides of the prison, basically from the northeast corner and from the southwest corner. And it involved the use of suicide car bombs as well as RPGs, mortar fire, and rockets.
How many Americans were wounded in the attack?
The military has given varying estimates, anywhere from around 2,000 to up to 44 soldiers and Marines wounded. They emphasize that most of those are fairly light wounds and that many of the troops returned to duty fairly quickly after the attack.
Well, was this an attempt at a prison break? What was the purpose of the attack, and did any prisoners get out?
As far as the military says, no prisoners got out, and I think they think that any attempt to figure out the motivation is purely speculation right now. Obviously, it's a prison, so trying to break people out wouldn't be out of the ordinary. And they do think that some evidence might point to the fact that it was a prison break directed not at the American side of the prison, but the Iraqi side of the prison, where Iraqi security forces were trying to hold Iraqi prisoners.
Are U.S. security forces or are the Iraqi security forces at all concerned over the scope of the attack, in that it involved a number of insurgent attackers and it seemed to be well coordinated? What are they saying in its wake?
Well, this is the second such attack we've seen in several weeks. There was one, a roadside ambush a few weeks ago that involved a similar number of insurgents. And we've been asking the military whether they think there's a pattern growing here, and they say that they don't have enough intelligence right now to figure out whether the insurgents have changed their tactics or their strategy.
All right, let's move on to Parliament. Iraqi politicians claim that they're moving forward finally. Is this it? Is the logjam broken? Will we see a president, a prime minister, a cabinet in the next few days, perhaps?
I think that this was an important step, a symbolic step, for the assembly to take because they feel that they could get past some of their differences. Again, this is a fairly minor post, though, and what remains to be seen is the appointment of the Presidency Council, which will then set in motion the two-week time limit to install the rest of the government. So we're hearing optimistic we're getting optimistic signs from several assembly members, several of the high-ranking assembly members, that they think that by Wednesday they should be able to appoint the Presidency Council.
Tell us who Hajim al-Hassani is.
Hajim al-Hassani is a Sunni Arab politician. He's fairly prominent among the Sunni parties that have worked with the Americans since the fall of Saddam Hussein. He was educated in the U.S. He got a Ph.D. from the University of Connecticut, and he spent around a dozen years in Los Angeles. So he has received a Western education. And when he returned to Iraq after the fall of Saddam, he joined up with the Iraqi Islamic Party, which is a conservative religious Sunni party. But he left that party last November during the invasion of Fallujah when the party tried to boycott the government.
Some think that al-Hassani has limited clout within the Sunni community. Is that true? And if so, what at a time when Iraqis need their politicians to lead them to stability, what do they get by choosing a guy with limited clout?
Well, that's the big dilemma of both the Americans and the Iraqi government here, is they want to bring people into the fold who will work with them, be friendly to them. But at the same time, they also want people who have some sort of influence in insurgents. And many times, those two goals are antithetical. Here, Mr. Hassani is clearly friendly to the Americans. He's been working with them since the beginning. But that might mean that he doesn't have very close ties to the insurgency, that the insurgents might not trust someone like this, might not give him as much respect as they would someone who's been boycotting the American occupation here since the beginning.
Tell us about the U.S. political presence these days. Are the Americans sitting on their hands?
The political office of the embassy here is fairly active. What they're doing is they're meeting with the Iraqis every day. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to avoid any appearance of directly intervening in the negotiations. So what they try to do is they try and urge the Iraqis to speed up the process. But the political officers tell me that what they try not to do is they try not to give specific instructions or lay out specific solutions or compromises that the Iraqis might be able to settle on, simply because that might make it seem as if the Americans are interfering in what should be a sovereign government.
So is this relationship working at this moment, the newly formed, that of the newly formed Iraqi government in its infancy and the American political presence?
Well, I think that what the Americans will need to do is wait until the government actually does get installed. I mean, right now it's still a sort of interregnum in which we're waiting for an executive branch of the government to come in. Now, a lot of the parties in the government, the most prominent parties, the ones who won many seats in elections, are ones that the Americans have worked with before, who sat on the governing council after the fall of Saddam. So the Americans are familiar with them. They're familiar with the Americans, and I don't think that the Americans will have to start from the bottom in terms of building a relationship with these guys.
Edward Wong, correspondent for the New York Times, thanks a lot for the update.
Thanks. I'll talk to you again soon.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, why is it that so many Catholics in America don't practice what is preached? You're listening to Here and Now. current debate over whether to set up private Social Security accounts has focused considerable attention on the impending retirement of the baby boom generation. The oldest baby boomers, who turn age 65 next year, will be eligible to start receiving Social Security retirement benefits in 2008. Considerable research has come out in the past year showing that most boomers intend to work at least part-time after reaching normal retirement age. The studies show they plan to work for both income and to stay actively engaged in the world. Here in Now's Business reporter Mark Mills joins us to talk about what these trends mean for Social Security, for the Social Security system, for businesses, and for boomers themselves. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Bob.
How does the idea of working beyond retirement age impact Social Security?
Well, according to studies from Merrill Lynch and the AARP, between 75 and 80% of boomers intend to do some kind of work after age 65. And for Social Security, that means millions of workers will continue to receive wages and will continue to pay into the Social Security system, even as they might also be collecting a Social Security check. But it does mean that income to the system will keep coming from people who normally would just be collecting. And for boomers, it helps address the problem of not having saved enough for retirement, and most haven't. By working longer, they can continue to save. Their savings can continue to compound and grow, and it prolongs the date when people start drawing down their savings, so it means fewer years when those retirement accounts have to be tapped for living expenses.
Working a full-time job up to age 70 or beyond seems like it would be a challenge for at least some. What do the surveys say about the boomers' plans for work in those later years?
Well, according to the AARP survey, more than half just want to work part-time for income and for personal satisfaction. About 17%, or one in six, want to start a business, perhaps in some area where they have a passion they want to pursue. 7% plan to continue to work full-time, and about 20% don't want to work at all in the retirement years. The Merrill Lynch survey shows many boomers want to cycle between periods of work and leisure. Many also indicate a desire to do some community service, so there could be a great pool of volunteer talent to help address society's needs.
Well, we hear a lot about downsizing in this economy and companies wanting to cut back on older workers who tend to be more highly paid. Will there be work for aging baby boomers?
Well, that's a big question. Some advocates for older workers have accused businesses of dumbsizing with their with their massive job cutbacks, claiming that businesses have been so obsessed with cost-cutting that they're getting rid of talented people they will someday wish they had back. But with low birth rates and a smaller working population coming up behind the boomers, many economists see a pending labor shortage for the U.S. and other Western countries, so the boomers may well be needed in the workforce. Work itself has become less physically demanding, so people can continue to work to a later age. Businesses are already using millions of people on a part-time or contract basis, so boomers can kind of plug into this growing contingent workforce idea. Some new models may have to be invented, some existing ones expanded. For example, maybe two people could share a job where they each work in rotating three-month cycles.
Now, what's behind all of this change? Why do the experts say that baby boomers will be reinventing retirement?
Well, first, people are going to be living longer. They're getting what is being described as a longevity bonus, and they want to make the most of it. Many people are healthier, they feel great, and they're ready to be active well beyond the traditional retirement age. So boomers will also need to work longer to fund their retirement, because many have not saved enough. Many of the older or leading-edge boomers, Bob, are experiencing a sense of freedom. They're becoming empty nesters. They've met most of their responsibilities at home and at work, and they're seeing this next stage as their time, and they want to put together a chapter in their lives of some work, leisure, more family time, some travel, and community service. It could very well be a very active and fulfilling period at a time, and we've traditionally pictured people slowing down and withdrawing. And, you know, growing up, the boomers saw themselves as agents for social change. They came of age protesting the Vietnam War and battling for civil rights and women's rights. This could be their next big movement.
I guess all of this means we're going to be here for 20 more years.
We'll be working for a long time, Bob. See you at work.
Thank you, Mark Mills.
Thank you, Bob.
Mark Mills reports on business for Here and Now. Stay with us. There is more ahead here and now. It's here and now. The Vatican has announced that Pope John Paul II will be buried on Friday in the grotto of St. Peter's Basilica. 2 million visitors are expected to visit Rome this week to pay homage to the late pontiff. Later this month, church leaders will choose a new pope who will face a sharply divided Catholic Church in the United States, reeling from priest sex abuse scandals and debate over some of the basic tenets of the church. Joining us to talk about the direction of the church in the United States is Sandra Yoakam-Mize, Chair of Religious Studies at the University of Dayton. Professor Yoakam-Mize, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure.
Let me ask you, first of all, what are the main areas of contention from your point of view that a large number of American Catholics have with the Vatican?
One major is the role of women in the church, and especially the role of women in leadership positions in the church. Second would be issues around leadership in the church in general, especially in light of the sexual abuse crisis. And then a third that has been ongoing for a long time centers around issues of personal morality.
What's the reason for the disconnect? The number of Catholics in the U.S. under Pope John Paul grew to 65 million people, but there's a decline in mass attendance, fewer families sending their children to Catholic school. What's the reason for the disconnect?
Certainly, there are these issues, these ongoing issues for some Catholics that has created a disconnect between their personal understanding of the faith and what they perceive to be what they're called to do as Catholics from the official positions of the church.
Well, John Paul moved the church toward a more orthodox position on many issues, leaving many Catholics in America out of step with Rome and people questioning whether a person can be a Catholic and not follow the church's teachings. In fact, only yesterday as I was driving along, I saw a bumper sticker just to that effect.
What you had with John Paul II was emphasizing certain points of disagreement as points of teaching that he wanted to emphasize, such as artificial means of birth control. On some of the central teachings, it appears that many Catholics still adhere to fairly traditional beliefs about who Jesus is, what the Eucharist means, what the sacraments mean. And then there are some of these personal morality issues where they have some serious disagreements.
Well, let's talk about those for just a second, if we can. As you point out, many Catholics do disagree with the Church's position on use of birth control. Many Catholics do disagree with the Church's position on abortion. And in your view, are those divisions likely to heal or just grow larger?
I don't think that we're going to see much change in most Catholics' positions on their views of use of artificial means of birth control. I do think that on abortion, many Catholics would make the kinds of distinctions that you hear politicians make. Personal opposition to abortion. They would never choose to have an abortion, but they do not want to make it the law of the land. And then there are other Catholics who simply think that there are times when abortion is permissible. So, again, I'd want to say in those areas we're probably going to see not very much movement.
Sandra Yoakam-Mize, Chair of Religious Studies at the University of Dayton. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
As we mentioned a few moments ago, there's a record number of Catholics in the United States. The growth in the American church is largely being attributed to the steady flow of immigrants. Here and Now's Fred Tice visited a community in the Boston area where newly arrived Brazilians are adding to a thriving parish.
St. Anthony's in Alston is a huge church built in 1896 by a previous wave of immigrants. It's now home to a growing Brazilian community. Father José Maria Ribeiro, who came to Boston from Sao Paulo 5 years ago, asks the newcomers to stand up. At least 2 new people join the congregation every week. There are so many lilies left over from Easter that the church is filled with their aroma. Prayers are offered for Pope John Paul II, but life goes on, and the community notes have to do with some of the parishioners' more pressing worldly concerns, such as immigration and workplace safety issues. The focus of the Mass is the Pope. During the service, a video obituary is played. It highlights, among other things, John Paul's opposition to the war in Iraq. After Mass, people head downstairs for a cafezinho, a small cup of the strong, sugared Brazilian coffee, and conversation.
What the post means to me?
Yes.
Everything.
Leandro Quintina is from Sao Paulo, but now lives in Everett. He's been in the U.S. 10 years. He's a limo driver.
He's a messenger from God.
Means a lot to me.
Ivete Nicoli is from Vitória on the southeastern coast of Brazil. She lives in Roslindale now. She's been in the U.S. for 18 years. She cleans houses.
He loved the poor, you know, he helped. He traveled all over the world to meet all these people that really need him. And I think he was the best that we ever had. I think I'm going to miss him a lot. I feel like I lost a father or something like that.
We have some disagreements.
Father Carlos Viana is a Jesuit priest from Joinville in southern Brazil. He's pursuing doctoral studies at Western Jesuit School of Theology in Cambridge. He's been in the U.S. since 2000. This is his second year working with this community.
This Pope is a kind of a paradox. He's a very charismatic person. Many people following enthusiastically, entering contact with him. But in terms of issues, in terms of doctrine, not everybody agrees with him. And that's the point.
Father Viana says he's a follower of liberation theology, which was suppressed by the Pope.
The Catholic Church seems to be too monolithic. Is not. The church has diversity. The Catholic Church is about receiving everybody else. In the homily, I mentioned that. Even though we may disagree with the Pope, but we have a strong sense of affiliation. We feel, Brazilians feel, that we lost a very close friend, a father. Papa for us is father. Father and Papa is the same word for us. So we lost a father.
Father Viana says he hopes that the conclave of cardinals will not elect a European, but will choose instead someone, in his words, from the outside, and especially someone who will listen.
That was Here and Now's Fred Tice reporting from Alston, Massachusetts. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Matt Largy, Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. And our interns are Katie Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.